Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to Intelligence Squared. I'm senior producer Connor Boyle. We're welcoming back a friend of the show today, the historian, author, and co-host of the Rest is History podcast, Tom Holland. His latest book is Pax, War and Peace in Rome's Golden Age. And joining him to discuss it is Hannah Cornwell, Associate Professor of Ancient History at the University of Birmingham. If you'd like to hear this episode ad-free and enjoy the full-length version, you can support our mission to foster honest debate and compelling conversations by heading to intelligencesquared.com/membership or by subscribing to our channel via Apple. Let's join Hannah Cornwell and Tom Holland in conversation.
Tom, welcome, and firstly, many congratulations on your latest book, Pax. So as a way into our discussion, I thought we might start with addressing a point that you raise in your preface, which is as readers, we seem continually fascinated with the ancient world and with Rome in particular, which you attribute to their sort of complete difference to ourselves. And you also stress in your preface that we should not understand the inhabitants of the Roman world, and I quote, on our terms, but on their own, in all their ambivalence, their complexity, and their contradictions. So I wonder if you could say a little bit more about how Pax addresses this and what are some of the main themes and ideas the book conveys in this regard?
Well, I think Rome does fascinate us more perhaps than any other ancient civilization. And I think that's partly because of the sheer quantity of records that we have from it. So we kind of feel that we know the Romans better. I think it's also because the glamour of the Roman Empire is more present in our imaginings. But I think it's also because we actually do feel that we're quite like the Romans. I think we are tempted to look back to Rome and see our own reflection in it. And that's been a constant throughout European history. I mean, almost the moment that the Roman Empire had fallen, there were kings who wanted to restore it, whether it's Charlemagne and then right the way through into the present day. The idea that Rome is something to be emulated, I think, has been an absolute constant. And the Rome that people want to emulate essentially is the period of the Pax Romana, the heyday of the Roman Empire, the period that Edward Gibbon famously described as being the period when the condition of humankind was at its happiest and most contented. Gibbon's take on this, of course, was shaded by the fact that he knew what was going to happen. He knew that this period of peace and prosperity was going to melt away and embark on the long process of decline and fall that is the great theme of his book. But he was also, his description of the heyday of the empire is kind of hedged around with mordancy and irony and ambivalence and all those qualities that you would expect from Gibbon. I mean, he's aware that it is an autocracy, that it is a military despotism effectively. And he has a kind of, drawing on Tacitus, I guess, a sense that the fruits of civilization are ambivalent, are not 100% to be praised. But he does kind of laud it as an unprecedented period of peace. And I think that even though today we are much more ambivalent towards, obviously, the character of imperialism, we don't take the idea that empires are ipso facto things to be celebrated. But even so, there remains this idea that if, for instance, we are looking at Hadrian's Wall, by and large, we are identifying with the people who are on the Roman side of the wall rather than on the Caledonian side of the wall. And I suppose the most influential modern contemporary manifestation of that is Game of Thrones, where Hadrian's Wall is transmuted into a colossally high wall of ice. But that was directly inspired by George R.R. Martin going to, I think, to Housesteads and visiting the site, in the dusk of a late English autumn, and imagining himself there. So I think that there is that enduring sense that when we look to the Romans, we do see, we are tempted to see ourselves, we are tempted to identify with the Romans. But I think that they are, I think that they were fathomably stranger and more terrifying than that leads us to think. And just going back to the other reason why I think we identify with them, why we're fascinated by them, it's the sense of glamour and ferocity. We're obsessed by them in the same way that the star of Jurassic Park is the Tyrannosaur.
It's a fantastic comparison, the Romans and the T-Rex. But I really appreciate in your book that you do stress the importance to acknowledge that they are different and that they need to be understood on their terms and not in the context of modern ideas of morality and civilization, if we're to really sort of get to grips with what's happening and why individuals within that world are doing what they're doing. You mentioned in that brief discussion about the importance of peace and this particular period of history, which for those who are about to read Tom's book, starts with the suicide of Nero in 68 AD and sort of takes us all the way through to the end of Hadrian's reign in 138. And as you say, sort of the idea of peace associated with this period has sort of been continuous in scholarship and the way we look back to the Roman past. I was very struck when reading your book and reflecting back on the first two books in what is now the Roman trilogy, how you're able to find that one word that pinpoints the crucial concept or the focus of the book. So you've got Rubicon, Dynasty, and now Pax. And you've already touched a little bit on this, but why for you is Pax the key concept through which to explore this period of the late first century to the mid second century AD? And this might lead us to discuss what Pax actually means, but that's quite a complicated question.
Well, if we translate it simply as peace, I think however revisionist you are, however skeptical of the achievements of Roman imperialism, the fact remains that the whole of the Mediterranean, because it has been brought under the rule of a single power, it is in a condition of peace that is exceptional by what had gone before, and indeed by what was to follow. And it does seem that this period, whether it's based in terms of the volume, say, of amphorae remains that are found, or the number of shipwrecks that are found on the bed of the Mediterranean, there are all kinds of ways of measuring trade and prosperity. But it does seem to have been, by the standards of the pre-industrial world, a period of prosperity. Now, what is the price? What's the price of that? And you talk about, Pax for the Romans is a very aggressive word. It doesn't have the kind of the slightly passive connotations that it has for us. Peace is upheld at the point of a sword. And this book begins in the fateful year AD 69, where the Julia-Claudian dynasty has ended. The bloodline of Augustus is extinct. Nero is gone. The question is then, who is going to rule the empire? And this is a question that prompts a period of near anarchy with four Caesars succeeding one another in very rapid succession. And it looks to many people at that period as though the empire is going to collapse, as though the crisis is a systemic one. But in the event, it turns out not to be systemic. It turns out these wars that convulse the empire turn out to be kind of surface eddies, and the long-term peace is upheld. But it's upheld by virtue of the same military resources that had temporarily had plunged the Roman world into civil war and anarchy, which is essentially that the autocracy of the Caesars is nothing without military power. It's that military power that upholds the peace. It's that military power that threatens the peace.
No, absolutely. And there's one point in your narrative, I mean, actually the concept of the importance of the legions, and the Praetorian Guard, but also taxation as a way of helping to maintain that sort of, it's threads throughout the entirety of your book. But there's one particular point when you're discussing the situation in Gaul and Germany. And I think you're not directly quoting, but it seems to me that you're paraphrasing a speech that Tacitus puts into the mouth of a Roman general when he's addressing Gallic leaders, that there can be no peace or calm among people without arms, no arms without military pay, and no military pay without taxes. This sort of argument about sort of, you know, why you need to submit to us. He talks to the Gallic leaders, you know, wars, there have always been wars for kings, and you have particularly desirable resources and land. You're always going to be subject to people attacking you unless you pay our, exactly, the price for our peace and our military protection is the tax. And so I wonder, yeah.
But the amazing thing about that is that it's in the context of a year that will be succeeded by Gallic nobility laying claim to a line of descent from Caesar, Julius Caesar, and kind of declaring a form of independence from the city of Rome that isn't, that is nevertheless also remains Roman. And the kind of the paradox of a Gallic empire that is claiming to be Roman is pointing towards what will basically be the future of Romanitas, a world in which to be Roman becomes something that is increasingly divorced from a sense of identification with the city of Rome itself. And I think that you can, this episode where essentially figures in Gaul and along the line of the Rhine have identified themselves with a particular understanding of Rome that is contrary to the regime that ends up being established in Rome by Vespasian and his armies. It's presented by Roman writers as a kind of barbarian rebellion or whatever, but it isn't really. Even though it involves Gallic the Gallic nobility, it actually remains a Roman civil war, and that is a kind of pointer to what will happen in the 3rd and 4th centuries.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed, so you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Absolutely, and when I was reading your book, and this is the point you just made about who is Roman, who is not, and how that changes and evolves, and how this Gallic Empire is, in fact, Roman, just sort of contrary to the Rome that's being constructed in the city of Rome. How similar that is to what's happening in the fall of the Republic and the Civil Wars, the question of whose version of the Roman state is the right one or the better one. It's a continuous sort of dialogue that goes all the way back really to the sort of, at least as the Romans tell it themselves, and Greek historians as well, the foundation of the city, a constant sort of conflict as to, you know, who forms the Roman state. But that did really strike me in a narrative about what it means to be Roman and who is included and who is excluded and how that changes over this period, both in terms of becoming more inclusive in terms of who the leaders are, but also the various peoples encompassed within the Pax Romana or on the boundaries of the empire, and particularly with one of the great monuments you've already mentioned, Hadrian's Wall, acting as a sort of barrier, along with other barriers that he creates and constructs around the Roman world to delimit who is Roman and who is barbarian. I suppose, could you say a little bit more about sort of that exploration about Romanitas, as you said, and what it is to be Roman and not Roman?
Well, it's right from the beginning. I mean, stories that are told of Rome is that it is it's a city for outsiders. So the asylum, a place on the Capitol, was supposedly, you know, the word comes from Romulus, the founder of Rome, the first king of Rome, saying anyone who comes here, doesn't matter whether you're a criminal or whatever, a refugee, you can come here and be enrolled as a Roman. And even as the bonds of citizenship throughout the Republican period are key to, I think, to explaining the military and social success of the Republic, at the same time, there is a recognition from other peoples, particularly Greeks, who are astounded by it, that the Romans are peculiarly generous or prodigal with their citizenship, depending on your perspective. And this is something that in the era of the Roman autocracy, the Roman state continues to accept. The Julia Claudian emperors, the Caesars who rule in a line of succession from Augustus, kind of recognize that they should be generous with the citizenship, for instance, towards Gauls. Under Claudius, people in the Senate, kind of conservatives, get very cross at the idea that that Gallic nobility might be coming to the Senate, and they kind of sneer about people wearing trousers and all this kind of thing. But actually, you know, the Gallic nobility by this point are wearing togas and thoroughly Romanized. And over the course of the decades that follows the year of the four emperors, the establishment of peace, first by the Flavian dynasty, so Vespasian and his two sons, Titus and Domitian, and then by the emperors that Gibbon characterizes as ruling over the happiest and most prosperous period of human history. So Nerva, Trajan, Hadrian, and their two heirs. The conditions of peace enable people, even in the East, where they are, where Greek speakers, the heirs of various kind of kings or whatever, to be enrolled in what you might call the Roman dream. The idea that leading figures from the eastern provinces as well can become senators, can become consuls even. And so you are starting to see, particularly under Hadrian, a man who as a child was called Graeculus, the little Greek, who was passionate about Greek culture, Greek civilization, adored Athens, adored everything about Greek civilization, enrolls the various cities of Greece, who back in the classical period had been famous for fighting one another, in a kind of Hellenic European Union, equivalent of the EU. And this sense that one of the great achievements of Roman rule is to provide the conditions of peace in which Greeks can fulfill their cultural destiny without fighting and tearing one another apart, becomes a kind of key marker of Roman civilization. And that sense that you know, people today talk about Graeco-Roman civilization, this is, by the time of Hadrian, this is something that is becoming more than just a platitude. It's vivid in Hadrian himself, it's vivid in the architecture that he sponsors, but it's vivid as well in the writings and the literature of the age. So the paradigmatic Graeco-Roman figure would be Plutarch, who is from Boeotia, the region dominated by Thebes, very proud Greek, but famously writes a series of paired biographies, combining, balancing Greek and Roman figures. And again, kind of looking forward to the very deep future in which the last capital of the Roman Empire will be Constantinople, a city that is Greek speaking. And to this day, you know, there are Muslims who think of the Greek world as Rumeli, as the kingdom of Rome, of Rome. So it is a kind of astonishing process of cultural change. And I think that this period is key in seeing a move away from old fashioned conservative Roman chauvinism to a kind of more an awareness that the identity of Roman is going to be more various. Now, that's not to say that there aren't lots of Romans who don't hate it. There are plenty, of whom I guess Juvenal is the most entertaining. But I think it is a process that smart, intelligent thinkers, of whom Hadrian would be the paradigm, are recognizing, you know, there's no going back from this. You've got to go with the flow.
Yeah, and I think that's something your book illustrates so well, not just in terms of the individuals you mentioned who, you know, sort of have multiple, as it were, sort of identities or origins, identifying as Greek or Bithynian, but also Roman, but also the sort of the territorial breadth of what the Roman Empire comes to encompass, how it can include Caledonia all the way through to Syria and North Africa, and how that allows us to expand our point of view about what the Roman world is. You know, we tend to think of it, or at least historically, as being the city of Rome, without realizing it actually includes parts of Asia and North Africa, and the diversity of people who inhabit those parts of the world.
So the scale of the Roman Empire in this period, I mean, we're so habituated. We do it at school. You look at maps of the Roman Empire in its heyday and you think, oh, that's quite big. But it's possible for your brain not to engage with the sheer scale of the lands and the territories that are ruled by the Caesars. And while I was doing the work, preparatory work on this, I began it under the lockdown. And of course, one of the things about the lockdown was that travel became, certainly by car or public transport, became much harder. And because we were legally allowed to take exercise, to walk from our front door, and you could go as far as you like and then walk back, we started taking advantage of that in the lockdown, and we ended up walking for miles and miles across London where we live, 20, 30, 40 miles. But it gave me a much more vivid sense of what life would have been like in a pre-industrial society where your horizons are bounded by the physical limits of often of how far you can walk. And writing the book and thinking about what it is actually like physically to walk 20 miles or 30 miles, and then looking at the maps, it gave me a much, much profounder respect for the vastness of the Roman world, and also how what an achievement it was to maintain transport links between all these various parts. So whether it's the shipping lanes that by and large are clear of piracy, you can essentially send large flotillas carrying grain or merchandise or whatever and be reasonably confident that if storms don't intervene, they will get to where they're meant to be going. And also the roads, these kind of, you know, these back in the days of the Roman conquest of these various territories had been like the meshes of a net cast over conquered territories, but which by this point are kind of more like sinews joining disparate areas. And I think that, again, one of the lessons of earlier and later periods of Roman history is how easy it is for these tendons to be cut, how easy it is for the various parts of the Roman world to be separated. So if you think about the civil wars that rage in the first century BC, whether it's between Julius Caesar or Pompey or the future Augustus and Mark Antony, that dividing line running down the Adriatic and across the Mediterranean, which in the long run, in the 4th and 5th centuries, will become the dividing line between the Eastern and Roman halves of the Roman Empire. I mean, it is there right from the beginning. It is a constant fracture point. And what the events of the Year of the Four Emperors suggest is that there are other ones. So there's the Pyrenees. So Galba, who is the first emperor to rule in succession to Nero, Spain is a stronghold because it's protected by the Pyrenees. He is the dominant Roman official in Spain. It's an inherent stronghold. The Alps likewise are a kind of major fracture point. The Channel, of course, and in the long run, it's these kind of fracture points that will lead to the disintegration of the empire in the West. And I think that keeping that in mind just enhances one respect for the incredible military, administrative, organizational achievement that it was simply to keep these lines of communication open and maintained.
Absolutely. I think there's a sense of it is a global network. You know, you talk about Rome being a global empire in the book. It is a network, as you say, the lines of communication, trade, network, the movement of peoples, particularly, you see that particularly in the army. And I think you have a nice instance of Graffito, or a piece of graffiti in Graffito in Pompeii, which is written in a dialect of Arabic. So someone's come from one side of the Mediterranean. And likewise, we see the same in Britain with inscriptions that are in Latin, but also in Palmyrene. So again, from the Far East. And just to sort of, as you said, to try and wrap our 21st century brains around and that kind of movement.
And of course, it's not just within the limits of the empire. So this is also the heyday of trade links with India. And one of the kind of the great dramatic kind of periods, areas of research in ancient history at the moment is the realization of just how rich and complex these were, centered not on the idea of silk roads, not land routes, but sea routes. So the various Red Sea ports, which had been originally set up by the Greek kings, the Ptolemies, and had then slightly gone into abeyance. But these are resurrected, revitalized, refurnished in the first and second centuries AD. And they send out fleets that go on the trade winds. They go to India, they go to Kerala, they stock up not just on goods from India, so that would be pepper or spices or whatever, but also goods from further afield, of which silk, of course, is the most celebrated. And then they get blown back on the trade winds. And this sense of a Romano-Egyptian and Indian world joined by these trade links is so interesting. I mean, it really is properly global and kind of provides a context for the great military expedition of the age, which is Trajan's attempt to conquer the one significant geopolitical entity that sits on the Roman borders, which is the Parthian Empire, and essentially blocks the trade routes between the Roman East and mainland India. And, you know, Trajan seems to have done tremendously well. He's the great conqueror. He's the Optimus Princeps, the best of emperors. But it all goes horribly wrong. And Trajan's reign ends up illustrating the timeless lesson, don't invade Iraq. So, I mean, the thing is that the kind of emblematic moment of for Trajan is arriving on the Persian Gulf and seeing a ship sailing away and being told, well, that's going to India. And this kind of this pathos, this yearning, this Alexander type desire to see the limits of the world is frustrated, even as it's kind of being satisfied by the quantity of merchandise that is coming into the Roman Empire.
That quantity of merchandise is, I suppose, something that, very beginning of your book, just before you start part one, the first chapter, you have two quotations, one from Pliny the Elder and one from Tacitus. And the Pliny the Elder one talks about the, let me just find the exact quote, so I'm not misquoting the translation here. Truly, it is though the Romans and the boundless majesty of their peace has been bestowed by the gods upon humanity. And in the fuller extent of the passage, which comes from the 27th book of Pliny's Natural Histories, he sort of embeds this idea of the immensa Romana Eparchis Maestate, so the immense majesty of the Roman peace, within a discussion of all these different types of plants that are coming from all over the world. So the Scythian plants, I mean, from Mount Atlas, the Pillars of Hercules, Britannica, Ethiopia, and it's all these plants coming to Rome. And although he doesn't link it with Vespasian's Temple of Peace, there have been arguments by people about planting within the Temple of Peace and the idea of botanical imperialism, that what is being put on display to Rome in terms of these trade routes, in terms of what had been brought and imported, is an expression through, in this case,
of power.
Of power, yeah.
Yeah,
and that goes back to, yeah, Pliny in his Natural Histories, and think you, again, quoting your book, you know, sort of the desire to sort of list or document everything is an expression of Roman control over the ability to list and catalogue.
As Gibbon is writing about, you know, his vision of the second century AD as this great golden age of peace, British naturalists are going around the world and bringing back cuttings and putting them in Kew Gardens. So there is a sense that, you know, Kew Gardens has been foretold by the Roman fascination with plants. And of course, the most celebrated, the thing that everyone knows about, the ambition of Romans to source living things that can illustrate the scope and sweep of Roman power is the most famous building that is built in Rome in this period, which is the Colosseum. the animals that are brought there are, I mean, they're designed to terrify, to stimulate, to a kind of inspire awe, but they're also designed to illustrate the sheer reach of Roman power. So you have a malefactor being gnawed in his vitals by a Caledonian bear, and the whole point is that it has come from Caledonia, the furthest, most barbarous midge-infested reaches of the world. Caesar commands it.
Yeah, this showcase of the exotic or the strange, or I suppose to an audience in Rome, almost the unreal, is achievable, as you said, because Caesar commands it. Just on that point, I suppose I was struck in the book about how many really vivid moments and descriptions of events there are, ranging from really quite harrowing descriptions to things which to a modern audience might be utterly alien or bizarre or almost comic. And I wondered if there were any particular episodes and events that you encountered whilst researching and writing the book that really sort of grabbed your attention or you wanted to discuss in more detail.
Well,
I know there are so many in the book.
But. Well, there are two iconic ones. And the first is the destruction of Jerusalem. So the Judeans, and I call them Judeans rather than Jews, because I think that calling the inhabitants of Judea Jews, in English, there are too many contemporary significations that hang around the word Jew, and it implies that it is fundamentally a religious war. I don't think that is the case. The Romans certainly saw the people of Judea as being peculiar, but the Romans saw pretty much everybody as being peculiar. You know, the Judeans were odd because they worshipped their one god, but the Syrians were odd because they were prone to castrating themselves, and the Britons were odd because they were prone to committing human sacrifice, and the Egyptians were odd because they worshipped gods with human heads. I mean, everyone was peculiar by Roman standards. But obviously, the reason why we attempted to look at the repression of the Judean revolt, which happens actually before the in the last years of Nero's reign, but is crushed in AD 70 when Titus, Vespasian's son, captures Jerusalem, incinerates it, and notoriously incinerates the Jewish temple. I think one of the reasons why we are prone to imagine this as being a religious war is because the destruction of Judea's metropolis, Jerusalem, and the destruction of its temple, meaning that the cultic practices, the habits of sacrifice that it was taken for granted in the ancient world were what hallowed a people's relationship to their gods, that the people of Judea no longer have this, and yet they maintain their identity in the long run, as we know, right the way into the present day. And this involves them becoming genuinely a very, very unusual people, even by the standards of the Romans. But at the time that Jerusalem is destroyed, I don't think that is the case. And it's the destruction of Jerusalem that really sets the Judeans on the path to becoming Jews, if you want to kind of put it like that. And so I think that the destruction of Jerusalem is by far the most geopolitically significant event that I describe. I mean, the implications of it, the consequence of it, reverberate right the way into the present day. Because, of course, the site of the Temple Mount, where the temple had stood, is now occupied by the Dome of the Rock, a building that is sacred to Muslims. So it is the fact that this remains as an incredible flashpoint. You know, if Titus if the Judeans hadn't revolted, but, you know, I mean, it's hard to think how different things might have been. And so the events, the account of the destruction of Jerusalem, which we get from Josephus, who is in Titus's train at the time, we can't 100% trust Josephus. I mean, not just because he is spin doctoring his own role and the role of Titus, but also because of the weathering effects of memory and trauma and shock. It's such a horrendous account. But what you get from Josephus is a sense that must be accurate of the terror and the horror of that siege. This was the greatest siege in in Roman history since the capture of Carthage. And Josephus's account does full justice to the terror and the horror of it. The details may not be entirely accurate, but as an illustration of what offences against the Roman peace might bring on the heads of offenders, it's unparalleled. So I wanted to bring that alive to people. I wanted people to experience the suffering and the horror of that siege as though it was something, you know, being reported from the front line in Ukraine or whatever, that sense of vividness. And the other episode, of course, is probably the most famous destruction of a city, maybe even more famous than the destruction of Jerusalem in the popular imagination, which is that of Pompeii. It's a story that's often been told. I mean, it's the first thing that people learn in Latin is, you know, the Pompeian figures being in Horto. And yet what I've never read of a full narrative account of what happens when Vesuvius erupts that blends all the various elements of evidence, which is, of course, written. So Pliny's letters, the younger Pliny, and all the various inscriptions that have been kind of garnered from Pompeii and Herculaneum and further afield, and the references to the disaster in other historians. But also, of course, the archaeological record. And what I found most fascinating of all doing the research is, which is the understanding that we now have of it that derives from volcanology, the way that volcanologists have looked at it and have essentially kind of worked out pretty much what the stages of the eruption were and therefore what that meant for people in its path. And so I really, really enjoyed fusing all those disparate elements of pieces of evidence and fusing them together into what I hope is not just a coherent but a relatively accurate account of what happened. And putting it like that, you just realize again, I mean, how horrendous it must have been. I mean, just terrifying, even for those who survived it. And what's amazing is not the scale of the trauma that it obviously inflicted, but relatively speaking, how little trace it leaves in the written records. Because the conclusion I came to, and I don't know whether you'd agree on this, is that the very, very enigmatic figure of Domitian, who succeeded Titus, who had sacked Jerusalem, is emperor when Vesuvius erupts, but dies very soon afterwards, and is succeeded by Domitian, who rules for a fair few years and then is assassinated, and his memory is kind of blackened by his heirs. But I think that so much of what he is doing and what Titus is doing is governed by a sense of the horror that has overwhelmed the Roman world in this period. So not just the war, but the destruction of Pompeii and Herculaneum, the plagues that hit Rome in this period, the destruction by fire twice within the period of pretty much a decade of the great temple to Jupiter on the Capitoline Hill, the holy, you know, so we think of the temple in Jerusalem as being, you know, a totemic, iconic figure sacred to the gods. But so too is another temple, this temple that also gets destroyed a few months before the destruction of the Temple of Jerusalem and then burns down again a decade later. And I think the trauma of this is measurably immense on Domitian and explains the kind of emperor he becomes, which is a very, very autocratic figure, convinced that it is his God-appointed duty to reform the Roman people. There's almost a kind of Christian quality to him. I kept thinking when I was writing about him how suited he would have been to the 4th or 5th century. You know, he would have... It's almost as though his understanding of the divine, of the supernatural, of the gods, is so strong that it almost requires a kind of single god, right, of the kind that Constantine had introduced.
Wonderful. And final question, which hopefully will be a short one, from Amelia. Were you taken aback by the success of the Rest is History podcast?
Completely taken aback. I originally started it basically to to have a way to promote my books. So I'm amazed that it's it has as many followers as it does, and that it's now absorbing as much of my time as it does, and, you know, absolutely thrilled by it. It's been a kind of transformative experience. Absolutely, you know, and it's like doing a constant history degree. You know, we're doing different topics every week, lots of which I knew very little about. And the opportunity to learn and study these different periods is constant source of stimulation and enjoyment. So I'm very grateful to everybody who listens to it.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Intelligence Squared. It was produced by Hannah Kay with editing from Tom Hall. If you'd like to enjoy a longer version of this, then head over to intelligencesquared.com/membership and sign up to enjoy even more member benefits. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should be talking about next. Send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcast@intelligencesquared.com. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our live events, or peruse over 20 years of the back catalogue featuring some of the world's great minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.